My Bondage and My Freedom by Frederick Douglass. Chapter 14. Experience in St. Michael's. St. Michael's, the village in which was now my new home, compared favorably with villages in slave states generally. There were a few comfortable dwellings in it, but the place as a whole wore a dull, slovenly, enterprise-forsaken aspect. The mass of the buildings were wood. They had never enjoyed the artificial adornment of paint, and time and storms had worn off the bright color of the wood, leaving them almost as black as buildings charred by a conflagration. St. Michael's had in former years, previous to 1833, for that was the year I went to reside there, enjoyed some reputation as a shipbuilding community. But that business had almost entirely given place to oyster fishing for the Baltimore and Philadelphia markets, a course of life highly unfavorable to morals, industry, and manners. Miles River was broad, and its oyster fishing grounds were extensive, and the fishermen were out often all day and a part of the night during autumn, winter, and spring. This exposure was an excuse for carrying with them in considerable quantities spirituous liquors, the then supposed best antidote for cold. Each canoe was supplied with its jug of rum, and tippling, among this class of the citizens of St. Michael's, became general. This drinking habit, in an ignorant population, fostered coarseness, vulgarity, and an indolent disregard for the social improvement of the place, so that it was admitted by the few sober thinking people who remained there that St. Michael's had become a very unsaintly, as well as unsightly place, before I went there to reside. I left Baltimore for St. Michael's in the month of March, 1833. I know the year because it was the one succeeding the first cholera in Baltimore, and was the year also of that strange phenomenon when the heavens seemed about to part with its starry train. I witnessed this gorgeous spectacle and was awestruck. The air seemed filled with bright descending messengers from the sky. It was about daybreak when I saw this sublime scene. I was not without the suggestion at the moment that it might be the harbinger of the coming of the Son of Man, and, in my then state of mind, I was prepared to hail him as my friend and deliverer. I had read that the stars shall fall from heaven, and they were now falling. I was suffering much in my mind. It did seem that every time the young tendrils of my affection became attached, they were rudely broken by some unnatural outside power, and I was beginning to look away to heaven for the rest denied me on earth. But to my story. It was now more than 7 years since I had lived with Master Thomas Auld, in the family of my old master on Colonel Lloyd's plantation. We were almost entire strangers to each other, for when I knew him at the house of my old master, it was not as master, but simply as Captain Auld, who had married old master's daughter. All my lessons concerning his temper and disposition, and the best methods of pleasing him, were yet to be learnt. Slaveholders, however, are not very ceremonious in approaching a slave, and my ignorance of the new material in shape of a master was but transient. Nor was my mistress long in making known her animus. She was not a Miss Lucretia, traces of whom I yet remembered, and the more especially as I saw them shining in the face of little Amanda, her daughter, now living under a stepmother's government. I had not forgotten the soft hand, guided by a tender heart, that bound up with healing balsam the gash made in my head by Ike, the son of Abel. Thomas and Rowena I found to be a well-matched pair. He was stingy, and she was cruel, and, what was quite natural in such cases, she possessed the ability to make him as cruel as herself, while she could easily descend to the level of his meanness. In the house of Master Thomas I was made, for the first time in 7 years, to feel the pinchings of hunger, and this was not very easy to bear, for, in all the changes of Master Hugh's family, there was no change in the bountifulness with which they supplied me with food. Not to give a slave enough to eat is meanness intensified, and it is so recognized among slaveholders generally in Maryland. The rule is, no matter how coarse the food, only let there be enough of it. This is the theory, and, in the part of Maryland I came from, the general practice accords with this theory. Lloyd's plantation was an exception, as was also the house of Master Thomas Auld. All know the lightness of Indian cornmeal as an article of food, and can easily judge from the following facts whether the statements I have made of the stinginess of Master Thomas are borne out. There were 4 slaves of us in the kitchen, and 4 whites in the great house: Thomas Auld, Mrs. Auld, Hadaway Auld, the brother of Thomas Auld, and little Amanda. The names of the slaves in the kitchen were Eliza, my sister, Priscilla, my aunt, Henny, my cousin, and myself. There were 8 persons in the family. There was, each week, 1/2 bushel of cornmeal brought from the mill, and in the kitchen cornmeal was almost our exclusive food, for very little else was allowed us. Out of this bushel of cornmeal, the family in the great house had a small loaf every morning, thus leaving us in the kitchen with not quite 1/2 a peck per week apiece. This allowance was less than 1/2 the allowance of food on Lloyd's plantation. It was not enough to subsist on, and we were, therefore, reduced to the wretched necessity of living at the expense of our neighbors. We were compelled either to beg or to steal, and we did both. I frankly confess that while I hated everything like stealing as such, I nevertheless did not hesitate to take food when I was hungry, wherever I could find it. Nor was this practice the mere result of an unreasoning instinct. It was, in my case, the result of a clear apprehension of the claims of morality. I weighed and considered the matter closely before I ventured to satisfy my hunger by such means. Considering that my labor and person were the property of Master Thomas, and that I was by him deprived of the necessaries of life, necessaries obtained by my own labor, it was easy to deduce the right to supply myself with what was my own. It was simply appropriating what was my own to the use of my master, since the health and strength derived from such food were exerted in his service. To be sure, this was stealing, according to the law and gospel I heard from St. Michael's pulpit, but I had already begun to attach less importance to what dropped from that quarter on that point, while, as yet, I retained my reverence for religion. It was not always convenient to steal from master, and the same reason why I might innocently steal from him did not seem to justify me in stealing from others. In the case of my master, it was only a question of removal, the taking his meat out of one tub and putting it into another. The ownership of the meat was not affected by the transaction. At first, he owned it in the tub, and last, he owned it in me. His meat house was not always open. There was a strict watch kept on that point, and the key was on a large bunch in Rowena's pocket. A great many times have we, poor creatures, been severely pinched with hunger when meat and bread have been molding under the lock while the key was in the pocket of our mistress. This had been so when she knew we were nearly half-starved, and yet that mistress, with saintly air, would kneel with her husband and pray each morning that a merciful God would bless them in basket and in store and save them at last in his kingdom. But I proceed with the argument. It was necessary that right to steal from others should be established, and this could only rest upon a wider range of generalization than that which supposed the right to steal from my master. It was some time before I arrived at this clear right. The reader will get some idea of my train of reasoning by a brief statement of the case. I am, thought I, not only the slave of Thomas, but I am the slave of society at large. Society at large has bound itself in form and in fact to assist Master Thomas in robbing me of my rightful liberty and of the just reward of my labor. Therefore, whatever rights I have against Master Thomas, I have equally against those confederated with him in robbing me of liberty. As society has marked me out as privileged plunder on the principle of self-preservation, I am justified in plundering in turn. Since each slave belongs to all must therefore belong to each. I shall here make a profession of faith, which may shock some, offend others, and be dissented from by all. It is this. Within the bounds of his just earnings, I hold that the slave is fully justified in helping himself to the gold and silver and the best apparel of his master or that of any other slaveholder, and that such taking is not stealing in any just sense of that word. The morality of free society can have no application to slave society. Slaveholders have made it almost impossible for the slave to commit any crime known either to the laws of God or to the laws of man. If he steals, he takes his own. If he kills his master, he imitates only the heroes of the revolution. Slaveholders I hold to be individually and collectively responsible for all the evils which grow out of the horrid relation, and I believe they will be so held at the judgment in the sight of a just God. Make a man a slave, and you rob him of moral responsibility. Freedom of choice is the essence of all accountability. But my kind readers are, probably, less concerned about my opinions than about that which more nearly touches my personal experience, albeit my opinions have in some sort been formed by that experience. Bad as slaveholders are, I have seldom met with one so entirely destitute of every element of character capable of inspiring respect as was my present master, Captain Thomas Auld. When I lived with him, I thought him incapable of a noble action. The leading trait in his character was intense selfishness. I think he was fully aware of this fact himself, and often tried to conceal it. Captain Auld was not a born slaveholder, not a birthright member of the slaveholding oligarchy. He was only a slaveholder by marriage right, and of all slaveholders, these latter are by far the most exacting. There was in him all the love of domination, the pride of mastery, and the swagger of authority. But his rule lacked the vital element of consistency. He could be cruel, but his methods of showing it were cowardly and evinced his meanness rather than his spirit. His commands were strong, his enforcement weak. Slaves are not insensible to the whole-souled characteristics of a generous, dashing slaveholder who is fearless of consequences, and they prefer a master of this bold and daring kind, even with the risk of being shot down for impudence to the fretful little soul who never uses the lash, but at the suggestion of a love of gain. Slaves, too, readily distinguish between the birthright bearing of the original slaveholder and the assumed attitudes of the accidental slaveholder, and while they cannot respect either, they certainly despise the latter more than the former. The luxury of having slaves wait upon him was something new to Master Thomas, and for it he was wholly unprepared. He was a slaveholder without the ability to hold or manage his slaves. We seldom called him Master, but generally addressed him by his Baycraft title, Captain Auld. It is easy to see that such conduct might do much to make him appear awkward and consequently fretful. His wife was especially solicitous to have us call her husband Master. Is your master at the store? Where is your master? Go and tell your master. I will make your master acquainted with your conduct, she would say. But we were inapt scholars, especially were I and my sister Eliza inapt in this particular. Aunt Priscilla was less stubborn and defiant in her spirit than Eliza and myself, and I think her road was less rough than ours. In the month of August 1833, when I had almost become desperate under the treatment of Master Thomas, and when I entertained more strongly than ever the oft-repeated determination to run away, a circumstance occurred which seemed to promise brighter and better days for us all. At a Methodist camp meeting held in the Bayside, a famous place for camp meetings, about 8 miles from St. Michael's, Master Thomas came out with a profession of religion. He had long been an object of interest to the church and to the ministers, as I had seen by the repeated visits and lengthy exhortations of the latter. He was a fish quite worth catching, for he had money and standing. In the community of St. Michael's, he was equal to the best citizen. He was strictly temperate, perhaps from principle, but most likely from interest. There was very little to do for him to give him the appearance of piety and to make him a pillar in the church. Well, the camp meeting continued a week. People gathered from all parts of the county, and 2 steamboat loads came from Baltimore. The ground was happily chosen. Seats were arranged, a stand erected, a rude altar fenced in, fronting the preacher's stand, with straw in it for the accommodation of mourners. This latter would hold at least 100 persons, in front and on the sides of the preacher's stand, and outside the long row of seats rose the first class of stately tents, each vying with the other in strength, neatness, and capacity for accommodating its inmates. Behind this first circle of tents was another, less imposing, which reached round the campground to the speaker's stand. Outside this second class of tents were covered wagons, ox carts, and vehicles of every shape and size. These served as tents to their owners. Outside of these, huge fires were burning. In all directions where roasting and boiling and frying were going on for the benefit of those who were attending to their own spiritual welfare within the circle. Behind the preacher's stand, a narrow space was marked out for the use of the colored people. There were no seats provided for this class of persons. The preachers addressed them over the left, if they addressed them at all. After the preaching was over at every service, an invitation was given to mourners to come into the pen, and in some cases ministers went out to persuade men and women to come in. By one of these ministers, Master Thomas Auld was persuaded to go inside the pen. I was deeply interested in that matter and followed, and though colored people were not allowed either in the pen or in front of the preacher's stand, I ventured to take my stand at a sort of halfway place between the blacks and whites, where I could distinctly see the movements of mourners and especially the progress of Master Thomas. If he has got religion, thought I, he will emancipate his slaves, and if he should not do so much as this, he will at any rate behave toward us more kindly and feed us more generously than he has heretofore done. Appealing to my own religious experience and judging my master by what was true in my own case, I could not regard him as soundly converted unless some such good results followed his profession of religion. But in my expectations I was doubly disappointed. Master Thomas was Master Thomas still. The fruits of his righteousness were to show themselves in no such way as I had anticipated. His conversion was not to change his relation toward men, at any rate not toward black men, but toward God. My faith, I confess, was not great. There was something in his appearance that, in my mind, cast a doubt over his conversion. Standing where I did, I could see his every movement. I watched narrowly while he remained in the little pen, and although I saw that his face was extremely red, and his hair disheveled, and though I heard him groan and saw a stray tear halting on his cheek as if inquiring, "Which way shall I go?" I could not wholly confide in the genuineness of his conversion. The hesitating behavior of that teardrop and its loneliness distressed me, and cast a doubt upon the whole transaction of which it was a part. But people said Captain Auld had come through, and it was for me to hope for the best. I was bound to do this in charity, for I too was religious, and had been in the church full 3 years, although now I was not more than 16 years old. Slaveholders may sometimes have confidence in the piety of some of their slaves, but the slaves seldom have confidence in the piety of their masters. "He can't go to heaven with our blood in his skirts," is a settled point in the creed of every slave, rising superior to all teaching to the contrary, and standing forever as a fixed fact. The highest evidence the slaveholder can give the slave of his acceptance with God is the emancipation of his slaves. This is proof that he is willing to give up all to God and for the sake of God. Not to do this was, in my estimation, and in the opinion of all the slaves, an evidence of half-heartedness, and wholly inconsistent with the idea of genuine conversion. I had read also, somewhere in the Methodist discipline, the following question and answer. Question: What shall be done for the extirpation of slavery? Answer: We declare that we are much as ever convinced of the great evil of slavery. Therefore, no slaveholder shall be eligible to any official station in our church. These words sounded in my ears for a long time and encouraged me to hope. But as I have before said, I was doomed to disappointment. Master Thomas seemed to be aware of my hopes and expectations concerning him. I have thought before now that he looked at me in answer to my glances as much as to say, "I will teach you, young man, that though I have parted with my sins, I have not parted with my sense. I shall hold my slaves and go to heaven too." Possibly to convince us that we must not presume too much upon his recent conversion, he became rather more rigid and stringent in his exactions. There always was a scarcity of good nature about the man, but now his whole countenance was soured over with the seemings of piety. His religion, therefore, neither made him emancipate his slaves, nor caused him to treat them with greater humanity. If religion had any effect on his character at all, it made him more cruel and hateful in all his ways. The natural wickedness of his heart had not been removed, but only reinforced by the profession of religion. Do I judge him harshly? God forbid. Facts are facts. Captain Auld made the greatest profession of piety. His house was literally a house of prayer. In the morning and in the evening, loud prayers and hymns were heard there, in which both himself and his wife joined. Yet no more meal was brought from the mill, no more attention was paid to the moral welfare of the kitchen, and nothing was done to make us feel that the heart of Master Thomas was one whit better than it was before he went into the little pen opposite to the preacher's stand on the campground. Our hopes, founded on the discipline, soon vanished, for the authorities let him into the church at once, and before he was out of his term of probation, I heard of his leading class. He distinguished himself greatly among the brethren, and was soon an exhorter. His progress was almost as rapid as the growth of the fabled vine of Jack's bean. No man was more active than he in revivals. He would go many miles to assist in carrying them on and in getting outsiders interested in religion. His house, being one of the holiest, if not the happiest, in St. Michael's, became the preacher's home. These preachers evidently liked to share Master Thomas's hospitality, for while he starved us, he stuffed them. 3 or 4 of these ambassadors of the gospel, according to Slavery, have been there at a time, all living on the fat of the land while we in the kitchen were nearly starving. Not often did we get a smile of recognition from these holy men. They seemed almost as unconcerned about our getting to heaven as they were about our getting out of slavery. To this general charge, there was one exception, the Reverend George Cookman. Unlike Reverend Messrs. Storks, Urey, Hickey, Humphrey, and Cooper, all whom were on the St. Michael circuit, he kindly took an interest in our temporal and spiritual welfare. Our souls and our bodies were all alike sacred in his sight, and he really had a good deal of genuine anti-slavery feeling mingled with his colonization ideas. There was not a slave in our neighborhood that did not love and almost venerate Mr. Cookman. It was pretty generally believed that he had been chiefly instrumental in bringing one of the largest slaveholders, Mr. Samuel Harrison, in that neighborhood, to emancipate all his slaves, and indeed the general impression was that Mr. Cookman had labored faithfully with slaveholders, whenever he met them, to induce them to emancipate their bondmen, and that he did this as a religious duty. When this good man was at our house, we were all sure to be called into prayers in the morning, and he was not slow in making inquiries as to the state of our minds, nor in giving us a word of exhortation and of encouragement. Great was the sorrow of all the slaves when this faithful preacher of the gospel was removed from the Talbot County circuit. He was an eloquent preacher, and possessed what few ministers south of Mason-Dixon's line possess or dare to show, that is, a warm and philanthropic heart. The Mr. Cookman, of whom I speak, was an Englishman by birth, and perished while on his way to England on board the ill-fated President. Could the thousands of slaves in Maryland know the fate of the good man, to whose words of comfort they were so largely indebted, they would thank me for dropping a tear on this page in memory of their favorite preacher, friend, and benefactor. But let me return to Master Thomas and to my experience after his conversion. In Baltimore I could occasionally get into a Sabbath school among the free children and receive lessons with the rest. But having already learned both to read and to write, I was more of a teacher than a pupil even there. When, however, I went back to the Eastern Shore and was at the house of Master Thomas, I was neither allowed to teach nor to be taught. The whole community, with but a single exception among the whites, frowned upon everything like imparting instruction either to slaves or to free colored persons. That single exception, a pious young man named Wilson, asked me one day if I would like to assist him in teaching a little Sabbath school at the house of a free colored man in St. Michael's named James Mitchell. The idea was to me a delightful one, and I told him I would gladly devote as much of my Sabbath as I could command to that most laudable work. Mr. Wilson soon mustered up 12 old spelling books and a few testaments, and we commenced operations with some 20 scholars in our Sunday school. Here, thought I, is something worth living for. Here is an excellent chance for usefulness, and I shall soon have a company of young friends, lovers of knowledge, like some of my Baltimore friends, from whom I now felt parted forever. Our first Sabbath passed delightfully, and I spent the week after very joyously. I could not go to Baltimore, but I could make a little Baltimore here. At our second meeting, I learned that there was some objection to the existence of the Sabbath school, and sure enough, we had scarcely got at work, good work, simply teaching a few colored children how to read the gospel of the Son of God, when in rushed a mob headed by Mr. Wright Fairbanks and Mr. Garrison West, 2 class leaders, and Master Thomas, who, armed with sticks and other missiles, drove us off and commanded us never to meet for such a purpose again. One of this pious crew told me that, as for my part, I wanted to be another Nat Turner, and if I did not look out, I should get as many balls into me as Nat did into him. Thus ended the infant Sabbath school in the town of St. Michael's. The reader will not be surprised when I say that the breaking up of my Sabbath school by these class leaders and professedly holy men did not serve to strengthen my religious convictions. The cloud over my St. Michael's home grew heavier and blacker than ever. It was not merely the agency of Master Thomas in breaking up and destroying my Sabbath school that shook my confidence in the power of Southern religion to make men wiser or better, but I saw in him all the cruelty and meanness after his conversion which he had exhibited before he made a profession of religion. His cruelty and meanness were especially displayed in his treatment of my unfortunate cousin Henny, whose lameness made her a burden to him. I have no extraordinary personal hard usage toward myself to complain of against him, but I have seen him tie up the lame and maimed woman, and whip her in a manner most brutal and shocking, and then, with blood-chilling blasphemy, he would quote the passage of Scripture, "That servant which knew his Lord's will and prepared not himself, neither did according to his will, shall be beaten with many stripes." Master would keep this lacerated woman tied up by her wrists to a bolt in the joist 3, 4, and 5 hours at a time. He would tie her up early in the morning, whip her with a cowskin before breakfast, leave her tied up, go to his store, and, returning to his dinner, repeat the castigation, laying on the rugged lash on flesh already made raw by repeated blows. He seemed desirous to get the poor girl out of existence, or at any rate off his hands. In proof of this, he afterwards gave her away to his sister, Sarah, Mrs. Klein, but as in the case of Master Hugh, Henny was soon returned on his hands. Finally, upon a pretense that he could do nothing with her, I use his own words, he set her adrift to take care of herself. Here was a recently converted man holding with tight grasp the well-framed and able-bodied slaves left him by old master, the persons who in freedom could have taken care of themselves, yet turning loose the only cripple among them virtually to starve and die. No doubt, had Master Thomas been asked by some pious northern brother why he continued to sustain the relation of a slaveholder to those whom he retained, his answer would have been precisely the same as many other religious slaveholders have returned to that inquiry. That is, I hold my slaves for their own good. Bad as my condition was when I lived with Master Thomas, I was soon to experience a life far more goading and bitter. The many differences springing up between myself and Master Thomas, owing to the clear perception I had of his character, and the boldness with which I defended myself against his capricious complaints, led him to declare that I was unsuited to his wants, that my city life had affected me perniciously, that, in fact, it had almost ruined me for every good purpose, and had fitted me for everything that was bad. One of my greatest faults or offences was that of letting his horse get away and go down to the farm belonging to his father-in-law. The animal had a liking for that farm, with which I fully sympathized. Whenever I let it out, it would go dashing down the road to Mr. Hamlin and frolic. My horse gone, of course, I must go after it. The explanation of our mutual attachment to the place is the same. The horse found there good pasturage, and I found there plenty of bread. Mr. Hamilton had his faults, but starving his slaves was not among them. He gave food in abundance, and that, too, of an excellent quality. In Mr. Hamilton's cook, Aunt Mary, I found a most generous and considerate friend. She never allowed me to go there without giving me bread enough to make good the deficiencies of a day or two. Master Thomas at last resolved to endure my behavior no longer. He could neither keep me nor his horse. We liked so well to be at his father-in-law's farm. I had now lived with him nearly 9 months, and he had given me a number of severe whippings, without any visible improvement in my character or my conduct, and now he resolved to put me out, as he said, to be broken. There was in the Bayside, very near the campground, where my master got his religious impressions, a man named Edward Covey, who enjoyed the execrated reputation of being a first-rate hand at breaking young negroes. This Covey was a poor man, a farm renter, and this reputation, hateful as it was to the slaves and to all good men, was at the same time of immense advantage to him. It enabled him to get his farm tilled with very little expense, compared with what it would have cost him without this most extraordinary reputation. Some slaveholders thought it an advantage to let Mr. Covey have the government of their slaves a year or two, almost free of charge, for the sake of the excellent training such slaves got under his happy management. Like some horse breakers noted for their skill who ride the best horses in the country without expense, Mr. Covey could have under him the most fiery bloods of the neighborhood for the simple reward of returning them to their owners well broken. Added to the natural fitness of Mr. Covey for the duties of his profession, he was said to enjoy religion, and was as strict in the cultivation of piety as he was in the cultivation of his farm. I was made aware of his character by some who had been under his hand, and while I could not look forward to going to him with any pleasure, I was glad to get away from St. Michael's. I was sure of getting enough to eat at Covey's, even if I suffered in other respects. This, to a hungry man, is not a prospect to be regarded with indifference. The end of chapter 14 of My Bondage and My Freedom by Frederick Douglass. Read by Rick Kistner for Lit2Go on the web at fcit.usf.edu.